Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 12:50 p.m. And today is March 12th, and it being Friday, it's a big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Something that I thought I would really concentrate on this week is governance. And it's a catchphrase that David coined years ago, and it was that in emerging markets, governance is everything. Because back in the 1980s, there was this perception that governance everywhere else seemed to be improving, so it was taken for granted. But certainly in the early 2000s, he recoined the phrase and just said governance is everything, because governance is not a static measure. It's a relative measure, but only relative to how you have performed before. So that's why emerging markets generally tend to do better, because they're coming off such a low base. So when they make improvements, then it has profound changes on the economy, on the potential for growth, and on asset prices generally. And that's also why investing in emerging markets tends to be so much more beneficial. But of course, governance can also get worse. And when governance gets worse, then it introduces a source of uncertainty. And the more that the standards of governance deteriorate, then the greater the source of uncertainty. So these are, I think, important characteristics. Now, we can think about what's happening right now in Singapore, and then think about how Singapore has evolved over time. Because for example, this is Jardine Matheson, and the share migrated from Hong Kong as soon as they announced that Hong Kong was going to pass back to China. They left. The company's businesses were split up. It was really an effort to ensure that they weren't taken over. They announced this week that Jardine Matheson and Jardine Strategic are going to recombine. And what I find interesting is that the stock did reasonably well. In fact, it did very well in the early 1990s, and then it peaked in 1993, and for the next decade it did nothing, and there was a significant decline in 97 and 98 as part of the Asian financial crisis. Then it went on an epic bull market, and we had this really impressive move in just about everything in Asia in the period from 2003 all the way up to about 2011-12. Well, then we've had this long range as well, and we had, of course, the very big decline in 2020, just like everything else, and it's another one of these instruments that had been on the cusp of breaking on the upside in the period right before the panicky environment in 2019 and 20, and subsequently is now coming back up again. Singapore successfully went from a backwater to being a successful private banking center and one of the largest pools of capital in the region through good governance. And that's an there's just no way to give sufficient credit to the foresight of Lee Kuan Yew in ensuring that good governance was something that was pioneered. And that had a profound effect on the stock market. So when we then think about the outlook for the STI index, well, it's been reconstituted over the course of the last decade, so we don't get all the back history. But the fact is, of course, that it was one of the Asian tigers. So these small economies, like Singapore, because of good governance. And then also when we saw that South Korea was able to evolve from also an economic backwater that had really been struggling, particularly after the Korean War, and they set up the Chaebol system and enforced a regime upon those emerging tech titans that they would have to compete and that they would have to be efficient, that there was absolutely no way that inefficiency would be tolerated. So that was the initial part of it. Of course, then they had to be revitalized in the 1980s and 90s. And subsequently, they came through that transition. They didn't do it voluntarily. It had to be forced upon them by the markets and certainly by some large institutional investors. Sovereign Wealth Management was a big participant in SK Corp's, I think, revitalization and the changeover in terms of how the company was really managed. Subsequently, some of South Korea's companies have become the largest in the world, and they've adopted it's now a democratic country. They're much more in tune with the liberal ideals of liberal democracies as a result of this profound change. Then, of course, you have Taiwan. They really were one of the first places that Japanese manufacturers went to. So then technology took off there. Then the incredible foresight and the adoption of fantastic management and great governance has been transformational for Taiwan Semiconductor. They have now become by far the most impressive of the tech companies, the share going from $4 to $118 over the course of the last 20 years is nothing short of phenomenal. And this is a testament to good governance as well. We can then think about the fact that each one of the Asian tigers had idiosyncrasies about the base from which they were coming, that they had come from a period of stress and difficulty, and then adopted a range of measures to instill good governance and an export-based economy, and then they had reaped the benefits subsequently. They then were able to transition from outright manufacturing to a much greater focus on research and development, on investment, and that has also helped to reap benefits over the subsequent period. Well, in just the same way that MBAs will be taught that you try it on a trial basis first and then you scale up your ambitions, the rest of the world was looking at the success of the Asian Tigers and thinking, golly, this really does work here. We've cracked the code in how to evolve these economies. And if good governance and free markets are adopted, then we're going to have serial success stories and the global economy is going to do nothing but benefit. So by the time we came around to the early 2000s and the opening up of China, there was a lot of enthusiasm that if China could be encouraged to liberalize its economy, to embrace free markets and capitalism, and was then afforded the opportunity to trade more freely with the rest of the world, that it would inevitably result in governance there continuing to improve, and that eventually democracy would flourish and the rest of the world would have a willing partner in economic growth. And it was going great for about the first decade. So we had this incredible bull market in commodities, and we had the flowering of enthusiasm that China was going to be a willing partner in development, that it was going to be the workshop of the world, that there was going to be a partnership between China and the rest of the world in terms of development, and that it was well worth the price of looking past the human rights abuses, because they weren't a permanent blot on the copybook. that instead that they would eventually start to migrate to a more liberal society where respect for human rights would be, a more of a priority, and that there would be much more, we would really enter a period of world peace. Well, when we look at, for example, simply thinking about how did commodities respond to the accession of China to the WTO, well, right around 2000, the CRB index was in the region of 200. By the time it peaked in 2008, it was at 450. So we had this incredible bull market in commodities because the growth in China as a result of accessing the global economy was incredibly profound. So they went on an incredible building boom. They've had an enormous property boom, which is still going. They have successfully lifted hundreds of millions of people out of poverty and into the middle classes. And yet, then we have not seen governance improve. So it certainly begs the question, well, what exactly and how do you measure governance? Well, historically, governance, in the way that we've certainly looked at it in this service, is to think about it from the perspective of an investor. So how does an investor make money? And that doesn't necessarily gel with whether the place that you're investing in is a nice place to live. Certainly when we then go back and think about Singapore, one thing that I think is particularly relevant is they still have single party rule. There are certainly elections, and it's simply that the ruling party has continued to win. They've also had a nepotistic transfer of power, so you still have the same family in power in Singapore, but the standards of economic governance are beyond question. So that is certainly true. There, it would be, I think, incorrect to say that they have an entirely free press, but it's free enough. What they certainly have is free capital markets, and they are certainly willing to enforce minority shareholder rights. And Singapore also has an independent judiciary and a very clear way of identifying, well, what is right, what is wrong, and how to fix it. And one of the key strengths that Singapore has would be that they look at what works around the world and then they copy it. And that would certainly be a good policy for any country. So you don't necessarily need to have democracy in order to have good governance and to create the conditions that are beneficial for investors. But some of the things that you do need are that you need respect for minority shareholder interests, because if you invest somewhere, it's always nice to know that you can go back and take your money out. Well, I know, for example, that when we think about Vietnam, it's a country that is doing better in terms of economic governance. They have built up, or they have followed China's model, and they have really gone for manufacturing, and they are now at capacity limits in terms of their manufacturing potential, because so much low-cost manufacturing is moving out of China, and indeed some of the higher-cost manufacturing is moving out as well. So they're a key beneficiary. Of course, they don't have a free capital account, and they're certainly not a free markets environment overall. I know of one investor, a personal friend, who had been investing in Vietnam, and when he wanted to sell his investment, he went to the bank and they said, oh, well, we can't give you your money back in electronic form. You'll have to come in. So he had to fly to Vietnam. And then when he got there, they said, oh, I'm sorry, your signatures don't match. So you may be interested in this alternative investment that we're currently promoting, and that would be a great place for you to put your money. So that's just a simple example of even in countries which are really doing very well, then it's not simply about an absolute level of governance, but rather that it is a relative comparison. It's certainly much better in terms of standards of governance in Vietnam today than it was 20 years ago. And it is reasonable to conclude that the pace and the potential for governance to improve is still very much intact. But one thing that I think is particularly relevant with regard to China and then also to Singapore is that a number of the senior Chinese officials were educated in political and economic policy by Singaporeans, and they used to travel habitually to Singapore for lessons. Now, one of the things that any teacher knows is that you can teach whatever you want, but you cannot control what your students learn. And obviously, China's administration certainly learned lessons from Singapore. They learned that if you adopt capital and capitalist tendencies, then you can grow your economy and you can become much wealthier. And that is going back to how Deng thought of the economy, that black cat, white cat, it doesn't matter as long as it catches mice. So that was certainly one of the most impressive things that the Chinese administration learned in Singapore. But of course, what they also learned was that if you improve your economy, then you can also continue to hold on to single party rule. And that's also something that China has been doing. But when we then go back and think about the kinds of challenges and the transformation that countries like Taiwan, South Korea, and Singapore went through to escape the middle income trap and become truly developed economies, well, they had to embrace more liberal ideals. And that's obviously a challenge for a country like China. So this is a choke point for what's going on in China today, because up until at the end of Jiang Zemin's regime, we had the kind of China administration that was interested in making money and growing the economy. Then we had a transition where people started to look at living standards and the loss of the Iron Rice Bowl. So that ushered in the accession of Xi Jinping. And what has become abundantly clear is that Xi's role model is neither Jiang or Deng, but Mao. So what he is in fact creating today is more of a personality cult in some of the primary communist mouthpieces are referring to him as a god, and that's not an exaggeration. When we then think about what's happening in terms of China's accession, it's become much more assertive internationally. So obviously that's an additional challenge. If one country that had previously been hoped for that it's going to become partners and subsequently wants to take over, that is inevitably going to create a source of stress. Obviously, there is a lot of discussion internationally about what this means. And the one thing that I find particularly relent is the Thucydides trap, because there are a large number of examples that are discussed in that, and what they are basically concluding is that most of the time you end up in a war. And the examples that they give of when major regime change and leadership in terms of global dominance changes hands, that have not resulted in a war, well, they use the USA and the UK as an example in the 20th century, but they ignore the fact that there was a war of independence nearly 100 years beforehand. So that notion of independence and dominance was settled well before the handover from the dominance of the pound to the dollar. Then the other examples have all taken place during the nuclear era. And that does suggest that we are going to continue to remain in a period of world peace relative to the potential for a world war as long as the nuclear deterrent is still relevant. So this is, I think, one of the most important factors, that we can think about what the potential is. We can see where there are risks, and we can think about what the trajectory of governance is like. Because with China becoming progressively more authoritarian, where there is no regard for minority shareholder interests, the only minority shareholders that matter are those that are part of the party and the party sponsors for private enterprise. And in many respects, private enterprise is only tolerated to the extent to which it serves the needs and ambitions of the party. Now, that is very akin to National Socialism. So that is the kind of evolution that definitely needs to be monitored. Then when we think about an independent judiciary, it doesn't exist. And then when we think about an independent press, it doesn't exist. Of course, we can think about this in the opposite direction. If there is no independent judiciary, it means that there are no laws. And there, if there is no rule of law, it means that everything is it's down to the fiat of politicians. Well, then if there are no laws and there's no independent if there's no independent judiciary and there's no independent press, it means then that news is completely manipulated. And effectively, you cannot believe anything that is said. So that's an additional consideration. Well, then when we think about what are the ambitions, the hope that China would see improving governance and that rising wealth of the country would transition into more of a liberal democracy, well, those hopes are fast fading. And instead, what we are looking at is the evolution of a totalitarian state that is becoming progressively more pushy internationally and is brooking absolutely no challenge to its authority and its way of looking at the world. And that is an outright threat to liberal democracy everywhere. Well, then we can think about, well, what is it that China needs in order to achieve their ambition of becoming the global hegemon? Well, obviously they need to do everything they can internally, and it really helps if externally everyone else is rather weak. And it's not like the standards of governance have been improving in the Western world either. So we can certainly think about the fact that the aftermath of the credit crisis resulted in the era of quantitative easing. And what quantitative easing was above all other factors was that it was a bailing out of private sector debtors at the cost of the sovereign. So central bank balance sheets have increased to profound levels. And when we think about the size of those balance sheets, I will admit I haven't actually looked at my measure for this in quite a long time. But we have seen this profound change in the size of central bank balance sheets over the course of the last decade, but most particularly since the credit crisis in 2008, we're up to 28.6 trillion. Now, that's had a massive distorting effect. It's been the primary driver of the asset price inflation we've had over the last 13 years. And that has also resulted in this incredible compression of government bonds. When we think about the fact that back in 1980, the yields were at an exaggerated high of about 16%. Before the financial crisis in 2008, they were 4.5%, and today they're 1.62%, and that's already 100 basis points off the lows that they were at a year ago. So this has had an incredible distorting effect. It's afforded governments the ability to borrow at extraordinarily low interest rates and to spend with little regard for how the money will ever be paid back. And one of the biggest challenges with the response to the pandemic has been that a lot of the money that was spent was going towards current spending and ensuring that just simply living expenses and survival expenses were given to consumers and businesses. All of the money that was spent was not driven towards productive assets. So we're not going to have much in the way of to show for all of the money that was spent during the year of 2020. But it also represents an exaggeration and an acceleration of what had already been going on for years, because people were bailed out of massive debts by the compression in yields. So the people who had debts in the late 70s and 1980s have done exceptionally well out of the environment, and they did even better in the period from 2008 onwards, because it was the holders of assets did best in the period from 2008 because of quantitative easing. If you didn't own assets, you didn't benefit. So that created this imbalance between the haves and the have-nots. It fueled the protest movements. Now, we first lurched to the right, and increasingly countries are lurching to the left. And this uncertainty that many people feel and the inequality that people have experienced is palpable. It's not going away. It's not going to be easy to fix. And it is creating internal strife. This is obviously also important because it means that there will be more spending. There will be more money printing. And because there hasn't been any negative consequence of this money printing over the course of the last decade, then politicians will be emboldened to continue spending. We can then think about what's going on in Europe. Well, the UK has left the EU, and the UK has also printed a great deal of money to deal with the pandemic. Then we can also think about what Rishi Sunak has done in the last budget, which is to give the Bank of England additional mandates. So now they don't just think about inflation and growth, but they are now also concerned with promoting the zero carbon policy of the UK. Now that's an outright political mandate for the central bank. So we haven't seen these types of political mandates for central banks since the 1970s. And it was these types of mistakes in terms of monetary policy and debt monetization that occurred in the early 1970s, which were a direct response to social unrest and the social justice movement of the 1960s that led to the inflationary spike that climaxed in 1980. It's hard to imagine that we would have had oil crises if the purchasing power of fiat currencies hadn't been deteriorating so rapidly into the period around 1974. So we're at certainly a period of greater uncertainty, and this absence of a clear willingness by politicians to address these challenges, that is representative of declining standards of governance too. Thankfully, investors don't buy countries, they buy companies. And companies are generally better managed. One of the bigger evolutions of policy from companies over the course of 2020 was that they took the opportunity of massive availability of credit to refinance. So the debt load probably did increase, but the interest rate expense for corporations has decreased, and then they have been able to stretch out maturities. So they don't need to come back to the market for ready sources of additional funding for really quite a long time. We're talking about years. That's not quite the same for governments. Governments have ongoing funding requirements, and those funding requirements are going to increase. We did see in here this week that the ECB has looked at what's been happening in German bonds, and with the yield back in the region of the highs from early 2000, they intervened yesterday to try and depress the yield. That was most beneficial for peripheral nations. They are certainly intervening to ensure that Italy's yield is not going to spike higher. In normal circumstances, a country like Italy would never be able to borrow at 62 basis points. But that is the opportunity afforded to it by the ECB. Europe is looking increasingly likely that there will be some form of debt forgiveness. Considering the quantity of debt that's outstanding for countries like Greece and Italy relative to their respective GDPs, then some form of debt forgiveness is largely inevitable. But it will come at a price, and that price will be closer integration for the Eurozone. Europe is an evolving superstate, and we can argue about the potential of whether that is democratic or not. But from an investor's perspective, if Europe becomes more of a superstate and continues to integrate and removes the doubt about the dissolution of the euro, then that is bullish. It's the kind of condition that will start to encourage investors, because Europe is less geared in terms of debt as an aggregate than either the USA or China. So that's perhaps the most bullish thing for Europe, that if they decide to mutualize the debt obligations of the EU, then on aggregate they will come out looking better. Now, when we look at what the European stock market looks like, it's been going sideways for really a profoundly long time. It peaked in 2000 and it really hasn't gone anywhere since. But it is coming back up towards the upper side of this range. And when we add the UK and Sweden, Denmark, Switzerland and Norway back into that index, well, then it's pushing on to new all-time highs this week. And these kinds of extraordinarily lengthy ranges, they generally are the seedbeds for new bull markets. So with the ECB starting to intervene to compress yields, then it ensures there will be ample liquidity. And it means that European companies are going to have continued access to accommodative liquidity conditions. So that's also positive. Of course, somebody has to pay for these low interest rates, and that will be savers and pensions. and insurance companies. So how do those pensions and insurance companies then hedge that exposure? Well, their ready answer has been to invest in alternative assets or to move into higher yielding assets like equities or further out in the risk curve in terms of bonds. But one of the most successful sources of alternative investments has been private equity. So then when we think about the fact that modern portfolio theory has been adopted everywhere, so that all pension funds are now managed on a modern portfolio theory basis, it means that by including alternative assets in one's portfolio, then the volatility goes down, which means the positions can be larger. And on aggregate, if you can find these unicorn-like alternative assets, then your portfolio will benefit. So there has been a massive swell of interest in private equity, and as a result of the low interest rate environment and the quantity of liquidity that's been created over the course of the last 12 months, then that interest has spiked. So we've definitely seen that there has been this incredible interest in SPACs, and the SPAC index rallied really very impressively from November through to the middle of February. And since then, it has pulled back in a rather abrupt manner, but we've certainly seen a rebound over the course of just the last 10 sessions. And the IPO index looks exactly the same. Of course, we've got more back history, and the IPO index, in fact, went up more. But it did bounce this week in rather emphatic fashion. We have a large number of markets that have bounced this week from the region of their respective trend means. The solar sector is another one, and the wind sector would be another example. Then, of course, we have the FANGs. And these sources, I guess all of these companies and these indices, ETFs, they represent a similar metric that they benefit when there is access to additional liquidity. When the market is flooded with liquidity, these growth scenarios do well. So the ARK index was well off its, the FANG index was well off its lows. Then the ARK Innovation ETF bounced rather impressively this week from the region of the trend mean. When we look at some of the companies that looked quite toppy, Nvidia, for example, it broke down for a brief period this week and then bounced back. So this is now looking like a failed downside break from that range. So if this is a failed downside break, it's quite likely to go all the way back up and test the upper side of the range. Amazon was another stock that was looking toppy and has at least steadied in the region of this 3000 level. We're at, I think, a rather interesting juncture for many of these indices, or I guess many of these stocks. They do have good governance. They are well managed, but unfortunately they are also interest rate sensitive, and bond yields are rising. And when the discount rate is reintroduced, then it robs the growth sector of the ability to inflate valuations indefinitely. When we look at the performance of value versus growth, well, it trended downwards for a decade. And we've now seen the biggest rally for value relative to growth since at least 2018, and I think perhaps more accurately since 2016. So now the question is, are bond yields going to continue to rally? Is this the end of the government bond bull market? Certainly we have a lot of evidence to suggest that there has been a mania in government bonds, that yields have compressed to extraordinary levels. There are trillions of dollars internationally with negative yields. And of course, we also have politicians who think that there are no negative consequences of spending and spending and spending. So they have been conditioned over the course of a lengthy career to just continue to spend and to never worry about the consequences. Many of the grey hairs in power have based their entire career on ability to borrow and spend for as much as they like, because interest rates have done nothing but compress. Eventually that will stop working. So now the question is, how willing will central banks be to intervene? We've certainly seen that the ECB intervened this week. I think then we think about, for example, the Australian government bond market has also seen a significant ramp up in yields, despite the fact that Australia has adopted quantitative easing for the first time over this last year. So now it's another question: how high will they allow these yields to go? I think Apple is one of the most interesting charts because it is in the region of its 200-day moving average. But it also has a tendency to be rather volatile and to pull back in an abrupt fashion and to find support more often in the region of the 1,000-day moving average, and most particularly in the region of the previous peak. So the most recent previous peak was at $80, and it's currently at $120. So it could pull back by a third before it would truly represent value, and that would, by that time, it would probably also coincide with the 1,000-day moving average. So if we do get central banks intervening and bringing down yields again, then that would certainly be beneficial for all of these instruments that are right in the region of their respective trend means. We certainly know that the USA is about to spend an additional $1.9 trillion. So that's still a lot of money. When we then think about what's going on in terms of those bond markets, I thought this was a rather interesting graphic I saw earlier on this week, and it looks at risk premiums. And every time risk premiums in the bond markets start to increase, well, it generally leads to trouble. Now, we can think about what is another measure of when does trouble arrive. Well, the spread between the 10-year yield and the S&P 500's yield. It generally does tend to run into trouble for markets when this spread goes up to around 100 basis points. Well, it's rising rapidly. Earlier this week, it went through zero, and it's just continuing to move. So I don't think we're really that far from the crunch point for the central bank overall. When we think about supply, well, the supply of bonds is going to increase substantially over the first quarter and second quarters of this year. But Treasury issuance is not being met by Fed buying. So if I were a bond market maker and I knew that I would be called upon to go off and buy bonds, well, the easy thing to do would be just to refuse. So you could just say, well, I'm not going to buy bonds yet because I think the yield is going to continue to rally. In fact, what I would much prefer to do is I'm going to short these bonds so that it will put greater pressure on the central bank, and eventually they'll have to intervene to put a floor under the bond price. And once they do that, well, then I'll capture a higher yield and I'll buy. Reverse my shorts, go long and pick up a very nice return. And that does appear to be what bond investors are doing. they know that it is going to have a material impact on the servicing costs of the government's debt. And I think it's really simple to think about this. If interest rates go from 3.25%, we can just simply think about that this is a mortgage payment calculator, but it's going to be the same thing for any kind of bond. The repayment on a 400 or from for every 100,000 at a rate of 3.25% is $435. If that rate goes to 3.5%, well, then it goes to $449. So that's a significant increase. And when you start multiplying up the quantity of debt that we have outstanding, then we're talking about billions. And then we can think about the fact that bond yields have gone up. They haven't gone up just by 25 basis points. They've gone up by 100 basis points. So let's just say if it goes from 3.5% to 4% on the mortgage rate, 4.5%, then it would go from 449 to 506. Well, that's a ninth in terms of the amount of money that now needs to be paid down on that debt. And these are significant changes. So we are approaching a point where there is going to be a problem in terms of the bond markets, and there will be leakage into other markets, because this is a very consistent trend, and it's got incredible commonality globally. So this is equally evident in European markets. Europe started to intervene this week, so they're starting to come back down. But that only suggests that there is a greater incentive to short the US market, because there is a clear incentive to capture as high a yield as possible before actually buying. Of course, all of this is representative of the deteriorating standards of governance. One of the questions that my daughters ask me is, why do so many people hate capitalism? And obviously they are active on social media platforms like Twitter and Instagram, and their generation and the people that their generation listens to are very anti-capitalist. And of course, that is a direct symptom of the deteriorating standards of governance that we have in many of the developed markets. People don't like capitalism because capitalism has failed them. One of the reasons why we have such political polarization is because neither party has been successful in tackling these very significant challenges. Younger generations tend to be very heavily burdened with debt, and they don't have the benefit, at least so far, of being able to inflate that debt away and having the wage growth pick up in tandem with it. One of the big repercussions of the 1970s was that inflation took off. Obviously, that was rather difficult to handle for a lot of people, particularly because wage growth did not keep pace with the increase in yields. But wages did increase, and they increased substantially. But a lot of the debt was fixed rate, so they were bailed out by the higher interest rates overall. That opportunity has not been available to younger people, and they're not benefiting from the system such as it is. They've certainly had to endure the kind of fiscal constraints and the benefits that quantitative easing heaped on asset holders, and didn't benefit the indebted group. So that's certainly a problem, and it will need to be fixed. The one thing that's encouraging is that democracies are flexible, and that means that the challenges can be aired, the challenges can be talked about, we can have elections, and there will be periods of time where we have this political uncertainty and lurches from the left to the right, but eventually a new equilibrium is found, and a lot of the problems of society will be addressed. From the perspective of the rest of the world, the navel-gazing that is going on in Europe and in the USA at present is an opportunity for much greater activism internationally. That is certainly true of what Russia is doing and of China. Both of those are totalitarian regimes. And then, of course, we have the additional point that the USA is energy independent. And oil prices are still a big determinant of economic growth. Well, the Brent crude price is now up to nearly $70, and it has been a little more volatile over the latter portion of this week. So we are getting a consolidation, but no real evidence yet that this advance is in fact over. We haven't yet seen a lot of evidence that drilling is coming back in a big way for the shale sector. And a good reason for that is because we've only recently seen the ability to hedge production out above $60 for at least the next 2 years. It's that consideration will be the green light for more drilling. When we think about where the secular bull markets are, the fact that we don't really have to think about where the new oil will come from as prices rise, that pretty much contains the potential that we're going to have a secular bull market, because you need supply inelasticity meets rising demand, and we just don't have it in oil. You have to really go to some of the most extreme forecasts to think about supply destruction and the impact of the green revolution. Well, certainly carbon credits, which are completely politically sponsored, are continuing to march higher. And this is new all-time highs. And we had a brief consolidation in the region of the peak and subsequently a very substantial breakout. So that's a very significant tailwind for the renewable energy sector. It's beneficial for everyone from Tesla to solar to wind to hydrogen, because they are automatically picking up a premium. Well, obviously that does represent a challenge for the conventional oil and gas sector. It's most particularly a challenge for the European oil and gas sector, which is why Royal Dutch Shell first pioneered a concentration on natural gas and is now looking to become a powerhouse in terms of production of electricity. So the share does look like a recovery candidate as a result. When we then think about what China is doing, well, they look at the fact that the USA is energy independent. So the USA no longer has nearly the same incentive to become the global policeman. So they're building a blue water navy, and they will certainly be in a position to protect their supply lines for everything from raw commodities to energy within the next few years. So that is going to create a very significant geopolitical challenge to the status quo overall. The choke point in terms of China's development is that they are not commodity independent, so they need to secure their supply chain. So that is that virtually ensures that they're going to continue to build a blue water navy and to project power internationally. It's essential to achieve their economic goals. Then they also want to become the global leader in new technology. There is certainly a choke point in terms of the semiconductor industry, and they know that that is a really significant inhibition to their global goals. Taiwan continues to exist in a legal grey area, and it's very much open to question whether the rest of the world will go to war to protect Taiwan. So the other way of thinking about this is maybe China won't invade Taiwan. Maybe instead they'll succeed in pioneering new technologies. They are certainly spending a great deal of money on quantum computing. So are other companies like Google, for example, and IBM would be another country, a company that has been spending a lot of money on quantum computing. China is also looking at optical computing, so no longer relying on silicon, but on photons and light signatures. And that is an emerging version of, or I guess, offshoot from the semiconductor industry. The reality is that Taiwan Semiconductor is down to 5 nanometers in terms of their chips and their production capacity, which is just an incredible technological feat. They have really taken over in terms of their ability and superseded the ability of Intel. But as we approach the physical constraints of the silicon atom, and the width of an atom, I think, in the region of 1 or 2 nanometers. So there aren't that many more iterations that we can anticipate. It does mean that there will have to be other solutions. So China is spending a great deal of money in developing those solutions. So that is perhaps one of the reasons why they may not have to invade anywhere else, if they can come up with the answers themselves. Of course, that will only heighten the geopolitical competition, because if China does become the world leader in technology, and it is certainly in with a fighting chance considering the quantity of money they're spending on research and development, then that will only further their aim of becoming the global hegemon. Well, then, in terms of energy, they certainly need to secure their supply chain, but they still have to pay for any of the exports that they bring in. And energy is obviously a massive expenditure. It's one of the key advantages that the dollar enjoys relative to other currencies, that the USA is energy independent and has the reserve currency. Now, the dollar has certainly rebounded to test the region of the trend mean and pulled back in the middle of this week and was a little firmer in here today. But there is no country willing to spend as much money as the USA is, and they want a weaker currency, and it is increasingly likely that they will get it. China is embarking on energy independence. When we think about the uranium price, I don't have a ready way of looking at it, because they're just not updated with any kind of reliability. So if we look at some of the miners, China announced this week that they are restarting their aggressive building program. So Denison Mines has popped on the upside over the course of the last few weeks. China is going to increase the number of reactors under construction significantly as part of their new 5-year plan. That's instrumental in terms of creating base load, so that any money that they spend on renewable energy will not go to waste either. And it suggests that the long winter for uranium may in fact be starting to come to an end. So I think that is an additional point that we can anticipate, that with greater global competition and with this clear geopolitical competition amping up as well, that there will clearly be investment opportunities. And obviously, from the perspective of an investor, governance is going to be one of the most critical deciding factors. There's a race on to become energy independent, And this is, I think, by far the most significant point for a lot of the green movements. One of the primary reasons it's being adopted by China and Europe is because the USA is energy independent already, and it represents an avenue for other competitive areas to become energy independent at the same time. So there will be continued demand for industrial resources. There will be continued demand for batteries. And this is the primary rationale behind the continued performance of the industrial metals sector. Obviously, we've had a period of time where gold has not been performing, and it has pulled back violently since August. Now, we're getting at least some evidence of near-term support. We're due at least $100 retracement of the oversold condition, and it really needs to sustain a move back above $1,800 and preferably back above the trend mean to confirm that we are coming out of this corrective environment overall. The one thing that I remain encouraged by is that the gold shares are bouncing from the upper side of their base formation, and that silver has continued to exhibit relative strength. Silver tends to lead in the second and third psychological perception stages of a bull market, and it is at least demonstrating near-term support in the region of the trend mean this week. Platinum is also completing its base formation and consolidating, and this looks like a first step above the base. But I also think that it is being viewed as an avenue to play the transition away from internal combustion engines and towards alternatives. Part of the reason for that is because one of the key components of a battery is nickel, and so is copper. And palladium is a byproduct of copper production. And I'm really not at all sure what's happened there on this palladium price. It looks to certainly be rather awry. Looks like a very bad tick for Bloomberg. And I'm not at all sure how to get around that. Let's just see if we draw it up again. Will it get better? It may not. There we go. Much better. The reality is that palladium is a byproduct of nickel. And if demand for batteries increases, more nickel will be produced. It means that more palladium will be produced. So the march of batteries will introduce greater supply of palladium, and the greater demand for platinum is tied to the evolution of hydrogen fuel cells. So the platinum-palladium ratio is in fact a play on the dominance of batteries over the internal combustion engine. So palladium is susceptible to additional weakness, but it is at least steadying from the region of the trend mean. And it may take time for the supply to start to come into the market, but there is absolutely no denying that prices are very high. We're still in a bull market overall. We're still in an environment where there is lots of liquidity, and this liquidity is likely to increase because the quantity of money being printed is putting upward pressure on government bond yields, and it will necessitate a response from central banks, and that will then result in additional liquidity. Central banks are not going to intervene voluntarily, but it looks increasingly likely that the bond market is going to force that, and eventually we're going to come to a point where they're not going to have much choice. The one sector that really forces the central bank, particularly the Fed, to intervene is the repo market. The Federal Reserve has a de facto standing repo facility. They simply cannot allow spreads in the repo market to widen in an alarming fashion. whenever that happens, they have no choice but to intervene. And with the quantity of money that is getting drawn down from the Fed as a result of the stimulus package getting passed yesterday, we are at a point where there will be some stress in the money markets. So that could be the catalyst for additional bond buying by the Federal Reserve, and that would be all the proof that investors need for going long once more. So we're still in a liquidity-rich environment. We're still in a benign environment for investors. We've had some pause in consolidation, and this week we've started to see that some of the risk-on appetite is coming back in because of the expectation that a lot of money is going to get spent and that it is going to further inflate asset prices. I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.